Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How can we thrive in a world where the future gets harder to predict with each passing year? Traditional strategies for coping with change have relied heavily on forecasting potential crises in order to prevent or at least counteract them. But all too often lately, those ideas seem to have backfired, as anti-terrorism efforts have produced more dangerous criminals, moves to stop the financial crisis seem to have worsened it, and meticulously negotiated peace plans have yielded more conflict. Joshua Cooper-Ramo has carefully considered these ironies in his current job as managing director of the geostrategic advisory firm Kissinger Associates and as the former foreign editor for Time magazine. He writes about the perspective he has gained in his new book, The Age of the Unthinkable, Why the New World Disorder Constantly Surprises Us and What We Can Do About It. Joshua, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Physics aside, it seems that the age when every action could be relied upon to produce an equal and opposite reaction are quickly coming to an end.
Yeah, I think they're gone, actually.
Yeah.
One of the lessons of my book is, you know, as I went around the world and spent time with people who were trying to disrupt the world order, it's the action matters, but it's the secondary effects that have the most dramatic impact. You know, 9/11 was huge and very important, but it was the things that happened afterwards which ultimately had the biggest repercussions. The subprime mortgage crisis was in and of itself a problem, but nothing compared to the havoc that it wreaked on the overall economy. And, you know, the reason for that is that we're all interconnected today, and that requires a totally new way of looking at the world that we've all got to learn.
Yeah, it's really interesting because there are these two ways of looking at globalization. One is that this vast network of links between us, between people and places, makes us all more stable, but at the same time, it also exposes us to new kinds of risks.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the things I did is I spent a lot of time with complex science thinkers. One of the ideas for the book was really to say, you know, what would happen if you applied chaos theory to international affairs, which, you know, looks more and more like a chaotic system. And one of the things you find is that network systems are, in fact, there are all these virtues, but in fact, as efficient as they are, they are also incredibly dangerous. In fact, the more efficient they are, as we've seen with financial markets, the more dangerous they are because they spread risk very quickly from one part of the system to the other. So every day now, as more people connect to a network, as more people connect to the Internet or join financial markets or start becoming a part of the global society and traveling, that means that produces new risks that we all share. And so I think for a long time we just sort of thought, well, great, we'll get everybody signed up for everything and, you know, then everybody will have cell phones, Internet connections, everything will be great. The reality is those things serve as vehicles for the propagation of risk.
Yeah. One of the things you looked at here as a metaphor was this sort of famous experiment with grains of sand dropped onto a pile. Can you talk about that?
Sure, absolutely. So, you know, one of the ideas of the book was to say how could we think differently about what's going on in the world today? Because one of the things I found is sort of as you travel around, people are really anxious and feeling like the old ways of thinking are kind of not working. And one of the ideas I had was saying, well, is there some different kind of conceptual way we can look at the world? And there's a great example from complex physics, which is this notion of a sand pile. If you just picture in your head sort of a pile of sand that looked like a little kind of upside-down cone that you'd built by dropping sand grains one after another onto a pile. Well, at some point, the sides of that sand cone would get steep enough if you kept dropping grains onto it that some would start to slide off, and that's called an avalanche in the sort of terminology of this experiment. And the issue with the sand pile is you can never predict exactly when an avalanche is going to happen. You could add 10 grains, nothing will happen. You can add 1,000 grains, nothing will happen. Then you add the next grain, boom, you get an avalanche. And so this is a complex system. The scientist who came up with this is a guy named Per Back, and what he said were systems like these were organized into instability. And they may look very stable. At any given moment, they're stable, but then they're just a hair's breadth away from collapse. Bach said they can collapse under the force of a small pin drop as easily as they can collapse under the force of a mighty blow. And that's our world today. Our world is not this sort of basically stable system. It is a system that every day, like that sand pile, is getting more complex. You can think of the grains of sand as sort of actors on the global stage, whether they're investors or people moving to cities or terrorist organizations. Our world order every second is getting more complex. And that makes it very, very difficult, if not impossible, to predict what's going to happen in the future. It requires a totally different way of thinking about our world and a totally different way of living.
Now, of course, some analysts will say that what we really need to do is just recalibrate the number of variables that we're looking at. But at some point, I guess that really becomes impossible.
Yeah, the problem is the world is so complex now, you just can't even begin to predict. And that's why you've got to change the way you think about things. And the problem, again, is this idea that many of the things we rely on to be modern, jet airplanes, financial markets, the Internet, these things can transfer risk easily as they create opportunity. And so we, you know, the only choice we have is sort of to say, all right, well, we'll just unplug from this world and we won't be modern in a way. We won't participate in these things. But as long as we want those things that make us modern, as long as we want, you know, the breakthroughs of bioengineering, then we have to take the risks that some guy in his basement is going to use the bioengineering tools to develop smallpox.
We should point out that there are a number of entities, both positive and negative forces on the world, that have rapidly learned how to exploit and really benefit from disrupting things.
Yeah. So, I mean, here's, you know, my when I started this book, I sort of said, you know, I'm going to just take some time and go hang out with people who are disrupting, and understanding that a lot of the disruption that goes on in the world today is disrupting for good. So, you know, when I spent time with the guys who had started Google or the best biotechnologists on the planet or the people who worked at Nintendo, what I learned from them is that if we're entering an age of disruption, it's not necessarily a nightmare, that for every group trying to do something bad with disruption, there are a dozen groups trying to do something good. But the thing we all have to accept is that disruption is an inevitable part of our future. There's not going to be stability. It's just a race now between people who want to disrupt for good and people who want to disrupt for bad. But that requires, first of all, that we change how our government works, which we can talk about, but also requires that each of us in our own lives begin to think in those terms. And I think already we're seeing evidence of this. I mean, you know, most people today don't just have one job over the course of their careers. They'll have five or six or seven jobs. And we have to constantly be changing our lives to better fit into an environment around us that is also changing very, very rapidly.
So you write that really the key to our success, if not our survival, whether as individuals or as a society, is building resiliency. Can you talk about how we need to do that?
Sure. You know, one of the, I remember at one point when I was working on the book, I went and spent time with Hezbollah, which is the terrorist group in Lebanon, which is, you know, just committed to absolute evil, but has been immune to Israeli attacks for years. I mean, in 2006, Israel attacked Hezbollah. And Hezbollah fired on the first day of the war and the last day of the war the exact same number of missiles, you know, despite this giant attack, just as a way of showing how resilient they were. And when I spent time with Hezbollah, that was the most obvious feature about them. It was not that they were armed to the teeth or not the intensity of their ideology. It was that they were built in such a way that the harder you hit them, they actually got stronger. When you bombed homes in southern Lebanon, you angered the population, which then encouraged them to support Hezbollah more. Hezbollah had found ways to help build schools and hospitals and other things that gave them more support. But they were living in a world where they could get struck at any minute, and so they had learned how to adapt. It's weird to think that we could learn something from that, but there's a couple things we can learn. First of all, we can learn how to attack them differently so that we go after their sources of resilience. But also for us, I mean, we are also confronted now with all of these threats from around the world. Our traditional way of dealing with these threats was something that was kind of known as deterrence, which, you know, people like my boss, Dr. Kissinger, really kind of pioneered, or perfected at least, which was this idea we saw during the Cold War of, you know, mutually assured destruction or kind of your dog is bigger than my dog foreign policy. That doesn't work today because so many of the threats we face in the world can't be deterred. You can't deter terrorists. They're actually happy to die. You're not going to scare them from attacking you. And things like swine flu or financial panic or any of these other dangers, you can't even, you know, there's no place to attack, really. And so as these dangers become more prevalent, we all have to focus more on our own resilience.
So we are trying overwhelmingly right now to sort of adapt to each new source of instability as it comes along. But as you note, our enemies and our adversaries are very often more nimble than we are. So will we ever be able to match them in terms of resilience?
Well, I'll be honest with you. That's the big question here. I mean, part of it is you need to have books like this that show the benefits of adapting and kind of bring readers inside the story of what that looks like. But, you know, I'll tell you, I used to be a journalist, and, you know, I was a magazine journalist. I was an editor at Time Magazine. And you look at the struggle that the journalism business, for instance, has had in adjusting to this new world order, the way, you know, newspapers or magazines have been really unable to make the leap to the world of the Internet. And then you look at, you know, the Fed and the State Department and the Department of Defense, and they are now also confronted with similar transitions. And, you know, the lesson for the world of journalism is not very optimistic. It's that big organizations with really, you know, storied histories have a very hard time leaving their past behind to do something radically different. But that is definitely what this moment requires. We need a level of kind of institutional innovation and risk-taking that is far beyond what these kinds of institutions are usually equipped for.
So if sort of tried and true responses to crises has become a liability in the current environment, how do we decide what is worth preserving, in fact, even at a greater cost to an organization, and what needs to be completely turned on its head and replaced?
Well, one of the ideas is that we've got to really start to see the world differently and to see the world as systems. In a revolutionary age where everything is connected, if you just focus on individual points, you miss a lot. So that's a problem we make all the time. We think, okay, let's just fix the subprime crisis, and we're not paying attention to the effects it's having on the rest of the economy, for months, really. Or we think, let's remove Saddam, and we don't think about everything swirling around him. So in the course of my research for the book, I found a very different way of looking at the world that a lot of revolutionaries or people who understand revolutionaries use. One of the guys I spent time with was a guy named Aaron Farkash, who was the head of Israeli military intelligence and really regarded as kind of one of the best spies of his generation. And he sat me down and said, look, I'm going to teach you how to think like and see like a spy. And one of the things that he did so well was he always thought of his enemies as systems. So when he looked at having to attack Hamas, for instance, instead of just attacking them on the surface, which was, going after the guys, blowing up the bombs or the people recruiting terrorists, he found that groups like Hezbollah actually had about 10 or 12 people in their core who were the most important. They were like the nodes in the network. And if you could take those guys out, you would immediately destroy the ability of the organization to function. And he was able to do that to some extent. Steve Jobs is another example of a guy who's a revolutionary who thinks of things in terms of systems. He didn't just think of things as a computer and a music player and a video device, but he was able to combine them all. And so one of the things we've got to do is adapt that skill of looking at things systemically. I talk in the book about a great experiment that a professor at the University of Michigan named Richard Nisbet did, where he took 20 Chinese students and 20 American students and studied them. What he did was he showed them each pictures, and the pictures were all the same. They were things like a tiger in a forest or a cow in a field. And then he used a machine to watch their eye movements. And what he saw was that the Americans would spend 80% of their time looking at the object in the center of the picture. And the Chinese spend 80% of their time looking at everything around that object. So if you showed the Chinese a cow in a field, they would spend most of their time actually looking at the field. And Nisbet's conclusion is this was a reflection of a very old Chinese way of thinking that sort of understood the world was constantly changing. And if you thought the world was always changing, of course, you would never just look at the center object. You would look all around. And I think as Americans, we do tend to focus too much on direct things and not spend enough time thinking about all of the swirling effects underway around us.
I mean, is part of the idea that the Chinese students think, well, I already know what a cow looks like because they all pretty much look the same?
Yeah, I think that's part of it. But also, if you've ever seen a classic Chinese painting, like the Shanshui paintings, as they're called, which are mountain and water paintings, the landscape is really big and the humans are always indicated by these little tiny flecks of paint. I think it's an expression that, humans or animals or any of this, we're all sort of a small part of a big, giant environment that is going to do what it wants to do. And at the end of the day, there's not a lot we can do to control that or shape our environment. It's not 100% the right way of looking at the world. I think the American way of looking at the world in many ways is better for the modern age. But in a period of rapid change, it's probably not a bad idea from time to time to say, what is going on with the environment right now? As Americans, we tend to have this idea that whatever we want to do, we can just go do it. The sort of frontier mentality that you're going to go out there and build it. The Chinese tend to be a little more studious of the environment before they will build something. They'll really try to understand what's going on and ask themselves, is this a propitious moment for me to do something?
Joshua Cooper Ramo is my guest. He is managing director of the geostrategic advisory firm Kissinger Associates. His new book is called The Age of the Unthinkable, Why the New World Disorder Constantly Surprises Us and What We Can Do About It. You're welcome to join our conversation by getting on the line now at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. We'll be back in just a minute.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, helping you to get ahead in today's tough economy. Hundreds of courses begin this summer. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Managing Director of Kissinger Associates, Joshua Cooper Ramo. His new book is called The Age of the Unthinkable, Why the New World Disorder Constantly Surprises Us and What You Can Do About It. We can do about it. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also join us via email to think@kera.org. I think, Joshua, your assessment of the value of curiosity in dealing with things as they are changing is something I haven't read in similar analyses. Will you talk about the difference between a fox and a hedgehog?
Sure. So one of the studies that I talk about in the book is this really interesting study where they were trying to figure out who's better at, what kind of people are better at predicting the future. And so a group of scientists went out and collected a group of several hundred scholars and asked them to make some predictions about the world 5 years in the future, you know, what was going to happen politically, what was happening economically. And then they classified them all on a wide number of spectrums. So they classified them as Republican or Democrat, as research as opposed to lecturing kinds of professors, as dozens and dozens of variables. One of the ways that they categorized them was based on this very famous essay by a guy named Isaiah Berlin, who once wrote that great minds come in two flavors. They're either hedgehogs or foxes. And the idea is that hedgehogs know one thing, but they know it really, really well, and they see the world through that perspective. And foxes know lots of things, and they kind of bounce around from idea to idea. I think we all know people like this. We know people who, you know, kind of have this wide-ranging curiosity. We know people who kind of obsess about the Civil War or football or whatever their one kind of thing is. And that turned out to be the only reliable predictor of people who were good at predicting the future. People who were foxes did a better job, a far better job, than the people who were hedgehogs. And part of that was it seemed somehow that if you had a curiosity of the world that allowed you to draw ideas from many different places, you had a better chance of figuring out what was going to go on in the world. You were more open to the idea that it was possible that something surprising could emerge in a given situation, which was really a very important breakthrough. And one of the lessons of the book, in fact, is that we live in an age now where you're constantly confronted with surprising combinations of different things. And so it's natural to see how if you had a personality that kind of looked for those things, you'd be in a better position to understand things. The hedgehogs were very interesting because I think actually psychologically most of us are hedgehogs. The hedgehogs had a very interesting sort of personality quirk, which was that they were looking for what psychologists call closure, which is that sense that just that they've answered a problem. It's like 2 + 2 = 4. We know it's always going to equal 4. We don't have to worry about it. Or emotionally, that reassurance you have from knowing, you know, that you're with your spouse and you'll be with your spouse forever, just that sense of kind of completeness. The foxes never had that. They were always thinking that whatever they had just learned, they had to reject and replace with some new idea. They were people who defined their lives by this kind of lifelong learning to some degree. And that, in our era, it's easy to see why that's very important. I've got a lot of examples in the book of people who survived revolutionary eras and made great fortunes precisely because they had this fox-like personality.
Joshua Cooper Ramo is my guest. His book is The Age of the Unthinkable. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we find Patrick in Richardson. Hi, Patrick.
Hi. I just want to say once again, what an amazing guest, what an amazing show. Mr. Cooper Ramo, I'm so excited to read your book. The last section of the show, you're talking about the fox and the hedgehog, is just so intrinsically fascinating.
Well,
my question is, the amount of impetus that is required to put into a system so that it causes disruption, but it doesn't bring the whole system down. Such as, let's take for instance that the system of narcotic sales through Mexico and America, just what's recently happened down in Mexico City. In order, when the first nuclear weapon was tested at the Day of Trinity, the physicists had no idea the explosive power that would actually generate from that. And it's been said that the physicists have had their Los Alamos, but the biologists have not had their Los Alamos yet. If that could have been translated hypothetically into a biological weapon of mass destruction where they didn't want to bring down the whole world, they wanted the virus to actually change and mutate away from Point Central of Mexico City, do you think that that's the evolution of weapons in the future?
Well, it's a great question, and one of the things I've got in the book is a whole discussion about the future of our physical security, and I have to tell you, I'm not very optimistic about it. One of the things that happens in history is that there's this thing called an offense-defense balance, and the idea is that there are periods in history when offensive weapons are dominant and periods where defensive are dominant. So if you look at the history of Europe, for instance, you had periods where fortifications were very strong, and so it was very hard to attack. And during those periods, defense was dominant, and the number of attacks went down. Then somebody developed a cannon which could actually break the walls of a fort, and it was easier to attack, and the number of attacks went up. And so throughout history, this is the case. You know, people invent the machine gun, and the number of attacks go up because it's fundamentally a great offensive weapon. People invent the tank, which is an offensive weapon that, you know, that produces the German blitzkrieg. And so, again, the relationship between the kind of weapons that are out there and the sort of era you live in is a pretty well-established historical fact. The Cold War that we just came out of was really a period of kind of defensive dominance because the nuclear weapons meant that it was really very costly to attack the other side. But today, it is incredibly cheap to launch an attack, whether that's a cyber attack or a 9/11 kind of attack, which costs less than $500,000, or as you were hinting, a bio attack. And so this is one of the transitions I think we've got to make, is to really understanding how dangerous our world is, how perilous our physical security is, and the fact that we keep spending more and more money on weapon systems, which are not, at the end of the day, actually purchasing us any security.
Yeah, can you talk for a minute about the U.S. investment in radar-seeking missiles?
Sure. One of the things I talk about in the book is I went and visited this air show in southern China. So I live mostly in China and have lived there for about 7 years. It's where I work, and it's in my view, one of the most interesting places on the planet. The Chinese are, you know, if you were the Chinese, you'd be doing the same thing, trying to worry about what they would ever do if they were attacked by a power like the United States. And one of their solutions has been to develop what are called asymmetric weapons, which is rather than going out and building aircraft carriers, they'll build less expensive submarines that can take out aircraft carriers. Or rather than building fighter planes, they will build missiles that take out the satellites that the fighter planes use for navigation. One of the things that they are selling, for instance, is something that is designed to confuse American airplanes in the sky. American airplanes have always relied on this idea that we're going to control the air over any country that we attack. And you'll remember in the first Gulf War and the second Gulf War in Kosovo, we very quickly were able to get control over the airspace, which allows us to conduct military operations on the ground. Well, the Chinese have developed a thing that makes it very hard to do that, because the way that you try to stop the U.S. from getting control of your airspace are these things called surface-to-air missiles. And we have these special planes and missiles, which are called high-speed anti-radiation missiles, that the minute you turn on a surface-to-air missile site to target our planes, the high-speed anti-radiation missile, sees you and then blows you up. And this is the reason why, during the first and second Gulf War, the radar operators just very quickly stopped even turning their radar on to try to hit the U.S. airplanes. It was just this guaranteed suicide, essentially. Well, the Chinese have a product that, you know, is a small electronic box, and when you plug it in and turn it on, it broadcasts something that looks like 10,000 signals from surface-to-air missiles. And so, but they're not really the signals. They're all fake signals. So you can imagine if you were flying over some valley and there's a surface-to-air missile site there, and all of a sudden you see 10,001 signals, of which one is only the real one. You don't know which one to attack. And that's an example. The Chinese call this an assassin's mace. It's a way of being particularly clever about using asymmetric technologies to take on stronger powers. And again, that's just an expression of the underlying shift of the physics in our world today. It is going to be ever easier for whether it's big countries like China or small organizations like Hezbollah to out-innovate us on a military level and really put us in danger.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Joshua Cooper Ramo's new book is called The Age of the Unthinkable. Let's go next to Bert in Dallas. Hello, Bert.
Hi. I think one of the problems facing us that kind of fits this paradigm you're talking about is global warming. You know, all the terrible things that are supposed to be going to come as a result of it, food insecurity flooding of coastlands, et cetera, et cetera, the list goes on, is really beginning to happen at a rapid rate, far faster than any political solutions in this country that are even being talked about. Even Europe has fallen down on their efforts. It seems to me that we're way past the point of really solving the carbon problem, but we're just going to have to start thinking in terms of, hey, it's here, and what are we going to do about it now as far as populations and the policies of living on the coast, and what are we going to do about agriculture, et cetera, et cetera. Where there's going to have to be a shift into just accepting this new world of heat. I wonder if you see anything like a shift happening, or what you think about that whole issue.
Sure, I think it's an incredibly important question, I agree with you, by the way. I mean, I don't feel any of the urgency on these issues that you would expect. And by the way, this is kind of a problem across the board today. It's one of the reasons I wrote this book. There's any number of issues, whether it's global warming or cyber terrorism. You know, we sort of identify these risks, but then we don't do anything about it. And, you know, that kind of paralysis is just fatal in these situations. I think it's absolutely possible to have kind of a revolutionary shift in the way we live. I mean, you could easily imagine a situation in which people were able to change the cars that they were driving or re-engineer cities, but it really is going to require a crisis to do that. And the problem with these slow-moving problems, when they're not flashing in front of you every day, is you tend to only pay attention to the crises. And that's a disaster. And I think really, you know, as you look at where we are today, I was just down in Washington yesterday talking to people, and you know, you just don't get that sense of urgency down there. It doesn't feel like a country that's kind of about to face really significant changes. It feels like a country that's, you know, 20% more active maybe in some areas than it was during the Bush administration, but generally speaking, kind of believes that the old solutions will work to some degree. And I think that sense of urgency, particularly on problems like resource consumption, global warming, pollution, is really very much missing today.
Is that unique, do you think, to Western or American culture, or is that something that humans just have a hard time with?
Well, you know, I think it is something humans have a hard time with. I also think it's part of our political structure, to a way. You know, one of the interesting things about living in China, for instance, is that the Chinese Communist Party, in some ways, is so precariously perched. They run that country. They have tremendous popular support, but they also recognize how that support demands that they are kind of constantly innovating and doing different things for the people if they can. And it really keeps them on their toes in a way. It's a party and a government that has huge, huge problems, both internally and the way the party functions, and in terms of the challenges that it faces in the overall environment in China. But they're definitely on their toes, and their system of government allows them to be very responsive in a way that our system of government doesn't. Now, that's not to say we should get rid of our system of government. I think ours is the best in the world. But we do have to find ways to engineer it so it can operate more efficiently and so that when we're faced with crises, we don't bog ourselves down in politics as usual.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Let's speak next with Robert in Arlington. Hello, Robert.
Hi. My question really relates to, if you look at the development of humans in a psychological sense, one of the biggest basic needs is stability and security. If you look at children who are neglected or have a very unstable childhood end up with a lot of psychological issues later on. That is all, you also see that in adults. I'm concerned that the speed at which our world is changing is going to create almost like a chronic stress in all humans, because the world changes so much that we have to do all this adapting all the time, new jobs, new governments, new weapons. How do we manage that? How do we keep that under control? Because our biology and our psychology is not designed to move that fast.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I think it is psychologically exhausting. I think as we contemplate our own future, it's one that's going to be exhausting. And the problem is we can't have stability. I agree with you. It's a thing people crave the most. It's what we all want. We want that sense that you all get, you know, that we get when we go home at night to our families at the end of the day, and you have this sense that things are kind of unshakable in at least one part of your life. The reality is the world is just not offering us that at the moment. And so we have to find ways to adjust and be stable during times of great strain. And one of the areas where we can do that, I sort of make a couple of recommendations in the book that I think each of us need to do with our own lives. One is to try to live more resilient lives personally. I think that matters a tremendous amount. If you have money saved in the bank, if you're taking care of your health, if you're exercising, if you're not consuming too much energy, you're in a far better position to absorb some sort of shock than you are if you're, you know, running a huge debt, your health's not any good, you're not haven't been spending time with your family. So, you know, basic things that we sort of used to think of as kind of like, well, it's good to do these things. Actually, they're very important to our fundamental survival today. And the second thing I talk a lot about in the book is this need for each of us to kind of begin to engage in the caring economy, for caring for people outside of our own homes, to spend some part of our careers really investing in making the world a better place, because the system we have in the world today is one that is creating, as you said, instability at an accelerating pace. And where a lot of people are shut out, we're going to go from 6 billion people on the planet to 9 billion people on the planet, you know, over the next 20 or 30 years. The vast majority of those arrivals will be shut out from the kind of benefits that everybody listening to this program has today, and with more and more power to disrupt our lives. And so I think there are practical things that we can do to try and offset some of that, but a lot of it means accepting the fundamental instability of the world, and that's very difficult to do. I'll add one kind of interesting side point about this, which is, you know, having lived in China as long as I have now, I've definitely absorbed a lot of the Chinese ways of thinking. And, you know, I'm still an American, but I can at least sort of see sometimes how they see things. And the Chinese are actually very good at managing a lot of change. If you think about it, the oldest book of Chinese philosophy is this book called The Book of Changes. most great Chinese philosophy emerged from a period 2,500 years ago called the Spring and Autumn and the Warring States period, which is this very unstable period, and is all about how to maintain stability. And the Chinese, one of the reasons Chinese put so much value on family, on cultivation of the individual, is that they believe that you're always living in an unstable external environment, and the best way to deal with that is to manage yourself, to manage your family, to make sure those things are well taken care of first.
For so long, Joshua, when things would change and realities would reemerge, the idea that was most popular was that we would make sort of gradual tweaks to the way we'd been doing things as opposed to sort of throwing out the baby with the bathwater. Can you talk about why you think that approach just isn't valid anymore?
Well, you know, it's very interesting. When people who live in history often have this sense of things happening gradually, but of course as we look back at history, we see it is punctuated by very dramatic moments like the First World War and the Second World War and the Civil War and these kinds of things. And history does tend to move in these very dramatic lurches in a way. We're competing with revolutionaries today, the people who want to disrupt the world order and make it more dangerous. The forces that are out there for disruption are all forces we can't manage using our traditional ways of thinking. And so we've got to make this leap. It's not so much a throwing the baby out with the bathwater as it is sort of a reevaluation of the world in a way. I talk in the book, again, a lot about this physics metaphor and trying to think of our world in terms of sort of quantum mechanics where things are highly complex, where there's a lot of uncertainty. Unlike Newtonian mechanics, which was the basic physics of, you know, dropping balls off of buildings where there was predictability. And when we switched from Newtonian mechanics to quantum mechanics, because Newtonian mechanics couldn't explain what was happening at a subatomic level, it didn't mean we junked Newtonian physics. We've kept it, but we've just had to develop a whole additional set of tools. And that's kind of how I feel. I don't think it's so much throwing the baby out with the bathwater as much as it is saying, you know what, there's some elements of this old way of working that work great and we should hold on to them. But it's also clear that in so many areas, every day we're faced with more dangers and often areas where, you know, we think we're using the right policies that just aren't working.
Joshua Cooper Ramo is managing director of Kissinger Associates. His new book is called The Age of the Unthinkable, Why the New World Disorder Constantly Surprises Us and What We Can Do About It. We'll be back to our conversation in a moment and welcome you to join us at 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, helping you to get ahead in today's tough economy. Hundreds of courses begin this summer. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Joshua Cooper Ramo. We're talking about his book, The Age of the Unthinkable, Why the New World Disorder Constantly Surprises Us and What We Can Do About It. You can join us at 800-933-5372. Going back to the idea of the study of history, is there still a benefit to be derived from it to the extent that in the past we have liked to study history and sort of hoped it would give us clues to the patterns of what might be coming ahead?
Chris, I think it's very important that we continue to study history. It's very funny. I was having a conversation about this last week with my boss, Dr. Kissinger, who, of course, was trained initially as a historian. And, you know, one of the things he was saying to me is that one of the most important things in making foreign policy is that you have a sense of history, that you have a sense of not necessarily the specifics of given moments as the teacher, but the sense that history does move in these cycles of kind of creation and destruction of moments where the old order, you know, disappears into air and is replaced by a new order. And I think history is a very useful guide in that regard and a very useful guide to this moment. I think when I call this the age of the unthinkable in the book, part of the reason for that is that usually at historic moments, that's what happens, is stuff that's just unimaginable, whether it's the collapse of the Roman Empire or the way World War I started very quickly, just comes out of nowhere. And, you know, there are few people at the time who will write a book that sort of explains, you know, what they think is about to happen, but most of the time, people don't have the sense of what's about to occur until it does occur. And, you know, history is a wonderful teacher. It reminds us that there's no such thing as the end of history. There's no idea that we've kind of reached a moment where the great ideological battles are done. I mean, I think anybody who believes that kind of democracy and capitalism are inevitable, should really be disqualified, frankly, from any kind of serious policy position. Those are, ideas that are essential to the United States identity, but they have to be fought for in every generation. And to think that we've kind of reached a point where we don't have to defend those things anymore, I think is wrong, and we've got to prepare ourselves for it.
Do you have a sense that we will, at some point in the future, move back to a place of relative stasis as compared to where we are right now?
It's hard to know. I mean, there's a number of people who argue we will, and that it'll be a bad stasis, that, people will become so afraid of change and so unable to process it that, one of the lessons of history is, frankly, when you do have moments where terrifying things are happening to people, that really awful people can become elevated into great positions of power. That's certainly what happened with Hitler in Germany in the 1930s, and it happens throughout history that when societies are afraid because they don't understand what's going on, they elect some strong man who promises to give them stability one way or another. That would be a disastrous way to get stability. A better way, I think, would be to kind of accept the fundamental dynamism of our world, to understand that there's no better system at the end of the day for managing that dynamism than the American system of democracy and capitalism, but it needs some adjustments so that it can perform better. Basically, I think I am optimistic that we can adjust. And partly, again, that's because I spent so much time with people who've done so well in these unstable systems. When I spent time with this guy, Mike Moritz, who's one of the billionaires of Silicon Valley, Silicon Valley is as unstable a place on Earth as you could possibly imagine. I mean, the minute you stop innovating out there, you're dead. Mike has accumulated a great fortune because he sort of found a way to get conversant with this notion that change is always happening and can be a good thing. And that stasis doesn't come back, but what does come back is a sort of sense of internal security that if you live your life according to the right values, you can absolutely manage even the most turbulent times.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next with Isabel in Dallas. Hello, Isabel.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead, please.
My comment really is more about the abuse of the Homeland Security and the NSA powers. I just really feel like, the things that Ramos is talking about is absolutely correct. We're at a crisis time, and the realignment or correction that needs to happen, it needs to happen right now.
And you would actually, Joshua, like to see the Department of Homeland Security replaced by something called the Department of Resilience.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think her point is a very good one. First of all, I mean, to particularly address these issues of the NSA, one of the things we have to worry about is that as we increasingly try to seek security in an insecure world, that we trade off our rights in the pursuit of security. That's a very common reaction. People say, well, things are very dangerous, so we'd like to, monitor your phone calls. The reality is that, generally speaking, that's not making us any safer. It's just the world is too complex now to think something like that inherently is going to save things. What we need instead is to understand, and I just cannot repeat this enough, that we are at a moment where risk is everywhere. The very things we need to be modern, that we want to improve the quality of our lives, make them more perilous. And so thinking of the Department of Homeland Security, which is kind of, building up this imaginary wall around the country to protect us against terrorists, terrorists are always going to find a hole through those things. And we just have to accept that we'll do our best to combat it, but some days we're probably likely going to fail to combat it. And we need to be prepared to absorb those shocks, deal with them appropriately, and move on and not let them wipe out our core values.
It's funny, though, that idea is anathema to some people who say you can't even entertain the notion that we'll take a hit now and then just respond appropriately to it.
Right. I think, and there's two things. First of all, I keep making the point, it is inevitable that we're going to take a hit. I mean, that is not an if question. It's a when. And we have to prepare for that. And it's going to come out of some area that we've never thought to prepare for in any way in our homeland security, because by definition, you're usually surprised by those things. And that then creates kind of an obligation for us today, I think, to really speak out and say, all right, how do we navigate this age? I mean, I call the book The Age of the Unthinkable, but it's not the age of the unexplainable. I think if you really can kind of get your head around what's going on, there's a tremendous amount you can do.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Athens and speak with Charles. Hey, Charles.
Yeah, hi. Just want to make a quick comment. We were talking about history just a moment ago. Anyone that thinks that they don't need to study history, I think, is probably on the wrong track. I mean, history isn't going to tell you what will happen, but it certainly can tell you what is likely to happen or what is at least possible.
Yep.
And if you know that, then at least you can make some provisions for it. And, the analogy that I'll draw right at this point, I mean, one of my favorites is to compare Islam as it exists now, what 1,500 years after its inception to Christianity during that same period of its growth. Hmm. And the parallels of behavior of Muslims now and Christians then are remarkably similar. Anyway, I just wanted to make that comment. I would totally agree with just about everything you said. You know, as a guy that used to fire the harm, however, there are some other aspects of it that make those little boxes the Chinese have pretty useless. Anyway, thank you for taking my call, and I really enjoyed the discussion.
Thanks for your call, Charles. Do you want to respond to that, Joshua?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, I think that is he's got it. That's the point, though. I mean, each of us has an obligation. You know, it sounds like he's ex-military, by the way, which is very important to understand, which is that, you know, the amazing thing about the American military is that for generation after generation, when Americans were called to serve, they did. And you could ask your parents or your grandparents, you know, what did you do when the country was faced with great crisis? This is exactly the same situation we're in today, but joining the military is not the only way to deal with this. And in some cases, as we've seen, military force doesn't solve these problems. And so, you know, we're entering a period of great disruption, and our children and our grandchildren will ask, what were you doing in 2008, 2009 when the system began to shift? And I think each of us has got to really say, are we doing what we should be doing? Are we standing up for what we believe in? And are we making the effort, first of all, to understand what's going on? Because I think sometimes what our politicians tell us is a little bit oversimplified. They don't necessarily trust us to figure things out ourselves.
I want to talk for a minute about this idea you have for establishing what you call a Department of Global Decency. Is it easier to take a sort of individual sense of altruism and scale it up to the federal level, or is it maybe preferable to start this at the top and hope that those behaviors will filter down to individual people to a greater
extent? My argument is that my idea of this department, in fact, is the first, which is I want to get and I believe you have to have tens of millions of Americans actively involved in this process of trying to help other people around the world. I don't think it's something that can be done from the center. I don't think it's something that can be managed by a few bureaucrats. I think one of the lessons, I talk a lot in the book today about sort of Internet entrepreneurs, and one of the lessons of the Internet is that you want to distribute power as widely as possible. The minute you give people more control to do things, they start producing amazing things, whether that's Wikipedia or other things. I mean, distributing power is the reason the Internet survived. There is no single central Internet server. It's distributed everywhere. And I think that's what a Department of Global Decency looks like. It is a department that would coordinate Americans' efforts to help us make a difference in the world, to improve the quality of other people's lives in the world, and not simply to do what we do today, which is just write checks.
You think it's reasonable to look at the current financial crisis as more than simply a temporary problem. Can you talk about why?
Yeah, sure. I think to me what it represents really in many regards is kind of an existential threat as much as anything else. There's a tremendous amount of instability built into the global financial system. And not only is it built in, but many of the players in the system are hugely incentivized to make it more disruptive. They make money when the markets are disruptive, and they can't be regulated using traditional tools. I mean, the problem we have today is we think we've got to fix the financial crisis. Let's regulate the banks. Well, the banks are important intermediaries, but like so many areas of our lives today, there's just an exploding number of participants in this space. So to just focus on the banks removes the possibility of dealing with some of the more disruptive forces in the system. So I think the financial crisis that we're facing today is really severe on a couple of levels. And in the book, I talked to a couple of hedge fund managers about, you know, fundamentally what's going on. And it's severe, first of all, because the power to disrupt global financial markets, to develop derivatives and new instruments, is still far greater than what regulators can keep up with. There's no way six guys in Washington can possibly keep up with, you know, the 25 smartest guys out of Wharton every year who are trying to figure out how to develop, you know, clever algorithms to make money. The second reason it's dangerous at the moment is that the policies we've chosen to respond to this financial crisis may in and of themselves in the long run produce another crisis, which is we are now financing these bank bailouts with an unbelievable amount of debt. The United States this year will issue $2 trillion worth of debt and will refinance another probably $900 billion. I mean, something like six times more than we've ever done in our history. I think it's probably possible that the market can bear it this once. It's going to be very challenging, and I think it's going to have major long-term impacts for the United States economy standing in the world. But you can't keep doing that over and over. And again, one of the lessons is the side effects of these things that are always worse than the real effects. And so, you know, the side effects of raising $2 trillion are potentially amazing. I mean, they can potentially crowd out other investment in the markets. They, you know, if you're borrowing from the United States at 8% and Hungary wants to raise money, well, they're going to have to pay 15%, right? So it can potentially lead to a default in places like Hungary or even in places like India, which then trigger political onslaughts. So, you know, the real issue here is not this crisis itself. It's all of these things around the crisis that are now starting to unspool.
We have time to go back to the phones one final time, and we will speak with Armand in Denton. Hi, Armand.
Hello.
Hey, go ahead, please.
Okay. I was just going to say it's a pleasure. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was going to ask, digressing a bit, about the age of religion that we kind of find ourselves in. Given the kind of coming together of, you know, religious interests across the board, what role do you think religion will play in the next, you know, decade or so, 15, 20 years?
I think it's hugely important. I think a lot of people have this idea that kind of as people get more modern, they get less religious. I think we have overwhelming evidence to say that that's not the case. The desire to be engaged in a meaningful spiritual life is a fundamental human desire. And at times it creates things like fundamentalist Islam. At times it creates things like, you know, missionary Christianity that's selfless and designed to help save people. And, you know, that's the challenge, is that this spirituality can cut both ways. But the idea that sort of, you know, as you make people more modern, as you give them television sets and the internet, they're going to be less interested in God, I think we've now seen that's not the case. And this is one of the problems with traditional foreign policy ways of thinking, is that they really think there's no place for morality in foreign policy. And the reality is, you know, many of the most powerful actors on the world stage today, whether they're terrorist organizations that are Islamic fundamentalists or groups like Greenpeace, are driven by profoundly ethical concerns. And so we've got to have an ethical dimension to how we look at the world.
How far out can we plan for the future in the current world?
Well, you can't plan precisely, which, by the way, is a great thing. I mean, right, because you couldn't have planned the iPhone. You couldn't have planned genetic injections into your heart to repair a, you know, malfunctioning heart mechanism. So, I mean, innovation, by definition, is unpredictable. What we can plan for, though, is a world in which the demand for innovation is going to be greater than ever before, because there's going to be constant new problems which are going to demand constant new solutions. And so the way we can prepare for the future is not with a specific set of answers that we lock into, but rather with a culture of creativity and innovation, and by focusing again on this idea of resilience, of really each of us waking up every morning and saying, what can I do today to be more resilient? That is the overwhelming characteristic of people who are successful that emerge from my book in a revolutionary period, is that they're resilient. And that's the sense of urgency we need as a country right now. It's not simply about recovering from this incredible economic shock we're going through, but it's about recovering in such a way that we can be resilient.
In our final 30 seconds or so, what's the most important step we can take in learning to visualize the world as it is now and working from that reality, as opposed to focusing on trying to create the world we wish we had?
Well, this is the key question. I think it is about always looking for these system effects. Whenever you want to do something, whether it's to make an investment or change jobs, don't be so narrow in the thinking. The example that I gave earlier of the kind of Chinese students who look at the whole environment, I think that's the most important thing. When we're trying to make a decision for ourselves, it's okay to study the environment first. And if the environment suggests this isn't a great time to move ahead with it, then don't move ahead with it. You know, take your time. Wait until the moment is propitious.
Joshua Cooper Ramo's new book is called The Age of the Unthinkable, Why the New World Disorder Constantly Surprises Us and What We Can Do About It. Joshua, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
It's been great, Chris. Thanks so much for having me on.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.